Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tyre. E-Range EV tyres are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tyre with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetyres.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E tyres.com to find your EV's next set of tyres.
Hello, it's Friday, which means it's Inside EV's podcast day, which is just the best, isn't it? Excuse me. My throat has been overcome with excitement. Today on the podcast, we have the ever wonderful Lacey, Miss Go Electric. Hello, Lacey. How are you?
Howdy. Hey, everyone.
You're good?
All good over here.
That's what we like to hear. And we also have the ever wonderful and effervescent Hazel Southwell. Hello, Hazel.
Hello. I'm very, very fresh today and feeling great.
And we're going to talk about why you're feeling fresh a little bit later. As ever, I am your host, Alex Goy, and we're going to try and guide you around the wonderful world of EV news that's happened this week. So what better time than the current moment to kick off with the news? Maybe.
EV news.
I like it's that the pun. News. The current news.
I'm just going to say yes. That was entirely intentional. That was entirely me. There's a lot to talk about this week, as ever, which is great. But our headline story is Hyundai, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, is going to use Tesla's NACS chargers from. On its refreshed and new cars in 2024 in the US and then the first half of 2025 in Canada. Lacey, how are we feeling about that?
I am very happy. I was a little nervous that these guys were holding out. And so some of these pictures actually were, accidentally leaked last week or during the week. And it looked to me, I was like, I don't know, maybe they're magic dock stations, but I'm glad that they are not and that these are going to be on the North American charging standard because, let's face it, the experience for charging is the best on the Tesla network, and I think this is the right direction. And actually, I think Hyundai is positioned really well, and so is Mercedes and GM, the others who have decided to go in together with the 8 automakers that are creating their own charging network infrastructure, but also then having NACS compatibility. I think that's a win-win, and they're positioned to be providing the best charging experience across the board in that case. So,
Hazel, what are your thoughts?
So it's Hyundai and Kia. So both of the brands are going in on it, which is good that it's not only like because Kia, I guess it's like a slightly less premium brand than Hyundai, although I understand that neither of them is considered very premium in the US. We was talking last week about the Kia, the difficulty with them competing with US brands because of things like not getting as many incentives towards the price of a car and stuff. So if they're going to remain competitive, if they're going to remain, you know, selling stuff in the US, then I feel like this is exactly the kind of thing that the brands need to do, because anything that makes your car that bit more attractive is going to be very important, and especially, you know, stuff that is localized to that market.
Anytime you talk to someone about someone new to EVs or someone trying them, the biggest complaint is, well, the charging infrastructure is rubbish. It's true over here. I mean, there's all these different companies vying for your money and vying for your subscription. None of it's easy. You've got to sign up to some things, or if you do tap and go, it's quite expensive. Whereas, you know, all the Tesla people are like, yeah, I bought a Tesla and I can charge it anywhere I want to, pretty much. They're convenient. the chargers themselves are in sensible places. They're well lit, or largely anyway, they're well lit. There'll be places you want to go so you can feel safe, and then you can do stuff while your car is filling itself up.
Whereas, and the chargers consistently work.
Yes, reliability.
Yes. Yes. Whereas I did a silly sort of very not typical use case road trip to Scotland in an EQS last year, and one of the chargers we had to use was around the back of some truck parking in a very unlit and not particularly salubrious bit of town, which didn't feel great. Not going to lie. So
not in your luxury sedan.
No, in my £130,000. Thing with the hyper screen and all that. So that's a very good thing. And Hyundai has also said that the Tesla network will support the fast charging on the eGMP platform, which is hugely important, because I guess the last thing you want is you've got the shiny platform that can do all the stuff, and then you go, yeah, but you can't, it won't work all the time. Some of the time, yeah, but not all the time. So we like that. That's good. That's good big news. It will take some of the worry away from how do I charge this thing, which is still where a lot of people are. It's so, yes, it's overall and good. We like that. Also and good, Toyota has come out, or is talking more about how it's going to build its EVs. It's revealed that there's three new ways of doing things. The first is a next-gen battery assembly line. The second is self-propelled assembly lines, which is pretty cool. And finally, gigacasting, which sounds awesome simply because it's called gigacasting. Guys, what are your thoughts on this? Have you how do you think it's going to work? Do you think the gamble will pay off?
I think that, so there's two elements to this. One of them is the shift to finding as yet unspecified ways of more efficiently coating batteries or battery elements, so that they can have bipolar cell modules and stuff. I, to be honest, I consider that one a bit hand wavy, in the sense that, like, they're like, we will make this more efficient, but it's like, but
we promise we definitely will. That's a thing we're going to do. Look, yeah, it's us, I mean,
saying that drum,
saying how they're going. I mean, they have sort of laid out, like, specifically this is how we're going to alter the physical structure and stuff in order to make it more compact, and if we can get a way of manufacturing these in a way that's efficient, then it will be good. So it's not nothing, but it's also kind of the thing about the autonomous assembly lines, I think, is really interesting, partly because it is actually quite realistic. So these are vehicles traveling at 0.22 miles an hour, which is very slow. That's slower than human walking by a long way. So this isn't the same as when Lotus announced that there'd be 140 mile an hour vehicles zooming around their autonomous Chinese assembly plant. It's also, so something that is a really, really big limitation for the whole automotive industry is production lines are obviously really good. And, you know, when Ford kind of really innovated them, although they didn't entirely start.
Well, he saw a meatpacking plant and went, what if we did that but in reverse?
So, like, with the development of production lines, it's something that the automotive industry in particular has really worked on, because that is where you can get, like, a big efficiency in terms of production costs. But they are limited by these rolling tracks that the vehicle is placed on, and it's much harder to rearrange kind of the robots around them, because you have to build this huge thing, and then it's actually quite rigid, and obviously it's very specific to vehicle size, it's and various other things. So if you instead have the vehicle effectively start as a skateboard, I suspect will be kind of how this works, like a battery on wheels fundamentally, and then have it kind of steadily rolling forward through this part of the assembly line where all the seats are fitted, etc. Yeah. And then finally the bodywork is put on the top. Then there's a lot more potential for adjustment. There's a lot more potential for kind of rapidly being able to change assembly lines, switch them between products, which at the moment, you know, you can't use I realize these are not electric cars, but like just as an example, you could not use an F-150 assembly line to build an F-250. They have to be completely separate, even though they're largely quite similar. That I can see is interesting, and it is an innovative idea. It's probably one of the biggest changes that we've seen in kind of like the idea of automotive production line for getting on for 100 years, to be honest.
Because part of what they're doing is they're splitting the car into three. So they do, you've got the front, the middle and the rear. So you can work on each bit independently, which hasn't been done before. So that's quite, as far as I'm aware, I could be wrong. Let me know in the comments. Speaking of, if you have any comments, do throw them in, and we'll answer them if we can.
I think also on top of that, the gigacasting is a big deal because you simplify it so much. I think in the article on Inside EVs, it said like the BZ4X had like 86 parts as far as components on just like the rear end of the vehicle, whereas this shrinks it down to, obviously, if it's a gigacasting, hopefully that one component where it really simplifies and speeds up that manufacturing process. This was probably when they launched the F-150 Lightning assembly line. I went out there for the event and did an assembly tour actually with Sandy Monroe. He was also at the event. We walked through there and talked about all the elements. So if you want to check that video out, I have it on my channel. But essentially what we had noticed, everything was at a standstill for the event. But while we were walking through, of course, they did have somewhat of a traditional assembly line, but they also had AGVs that would move certain components around the floor. It wasn't on a track system like we're seeing in these photos here. So these little automated devices just know that they need to go to the next stop. So then they transport it on a path on their own over to, so you can reprogram them however you want. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And I think that's kind of like the way forward as far as manufacturing goes in a more... in a way where you can kind of move it around a little bit, because as we've seen recently in this past week as well, is that they're expanding that line over and over again until they hit that guidance. And hopefully we'll see if they can get up to 150,000 annual units out of that facility for the Lightning. But that really gives you a little bit more flexibility, like Hazel was suggesting, that makes it better for you to quickly change what you possibly can for the manufacturing process. So it's good to see all the news that's coming out with Toyota. But yeah, this is great that you're moving towards this direction. Let's see it.
Yeah,
I am fascinated by them making this series of announcements, because it's all...
Look at us.
It's all very specific, and it's all very behind the scenes specific. Like, car companies don't generally talk about their like logistics and production line stuff. Like, it's not particularly the sort of, you know, they'll be like, hey, did you know that we broke the Nordschleifer record? Right. Not like, check out our robot.
Well, I will say, I think it was like an announcement a couple of years ago, maybe now, NVIDIA had announced that they were doing a way that you can map out your production in a more like cost-effective way. And BMW was a partner with them. So I get it on that front. If you're using like a huge tech giant to really advance the planning process of that. But otherwise, okay.
Sometimes it's cool to see how the sausage is made. Like, we've all visited where cars are made, and it's the kind of a ballet of humans and machines and all things moving around in bits. But yeah, it is oddly specific.
I think it's really interesting, but I'm just surprised that the world's largest car maker is kind of putting this all on the table like this. I don't know.
I guess, you know, the beginning of the piece is like Toyota has often been criticized for being late to the game, and maybe the justification is, look, we know we're late, but look at all the cool stuff we're doing. This is the best. Please enjoy how we're making the cars. The one thing I'm curious about, and this is where someone with a car design or proper engineering brain could maybe clarify with the gigacasting. So it's, you know, saying the BZ4X has an 84-piece rear end, and soon with the gigacasting it would be a single piece. does that limit the complexity of potential future design? Does it mean they will it mean that you can't make quite as exciting shapes? The Mark III Prius, for example, was quite a pointy, angry thing. I mean, it was ugly as sin, but it was at least geometrically interesting to look at. So I'm curious about that. I need to a bit more reading about it and talk to some car designery types, but I will come back with an answer unless either of you have it now or anyone in the comments has it. Because yeah,
that's a good question.
I'm curious because the only other car I know that uses, you know, single cast panels for front ends and rear ends is a Citroen Ami. And that's the same Tesla. Front and back. And oh and them. But yeah, will it limit things? Anyway,
Think it should limit design, but it will. Something I'm interested in is it's gonna limit some customizability or like it's the amount you can option a car, that definitely will be a bit more limited, I would have thought. Down to things like how many sensors and stuff like that, because it's all going to have to be considered in the original casting.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I wonder what that will do. Well, we shall find out in the fullness of time when Toyota's entire new range of EVs is slowly rolled out. We will be given the behind-the-scenes scoop via various conferences over the years, I'm sure. So this week's big thing that's kind of kicked off is the Q3 sales results have come in. Some of them good, some of them not so good. I've got some headlines here. So GM shifted 20,000 cars. That's up 33%. Ford, 21,000, which with a bit of a decrease in F-150. Hyundai has managed to quadruple its EV output, which is great. Rivian doubled. Tesla, 30,000 fewer due to a stoppage, but it's still saying it did 435,000 cars in the quarter, which is mad. Also, 60 to 70 of its semi trucks, and VW. As saying it managed 87,756. That's down 1.2%, but that's still an almighty number of vehicles. Where do we think, I mean, obviously the guys going up is great, the people going down, less so good, but is it showing that America is becoming more receptive to EVs? Because every time we get something like this over in the UK, there's a, that we always see that BEVs are going up, diesels going down, and that trend is sort of slowly increasing. So how is the American, it's a good indicator, right, that the American public is reacting well to EV?
I would say generally speaking, yes, that's the case. But I do think there's some difficulty getting it even better than what we're seeing right now. And obviously there's a lot of factors to it, whether that's, you know, many of these companies stopping their production lines to retool things like Ford. GM also has stopped completely BrightDrop deliveries and production of those. They've been struggling really hard to get the volume up on Ultium platforms, but it seems Bolt's still doing pretty good. It's a shame that it's going to be going away at the end of the year here. It's actually just rented one recently on Hertz. Every time I go on a trip, I try to rent an EV on their platform, but you know, it's just getting back in that again. I'm just like, this is a great little car, you know. It's just so disappointing that they're taking it away from us. But yeah, generally speaking, there's tons of stuff to consider. At Hyundai, they don't sell in every single state as far as their brands like cross board go. So that's a little frustrating in my opinion, because I wanted to buy one in Michigan, but I couldn't. Then there's, of course, you know, companies like Ford and Rivian who are providing new trim levels. So Ford this week said we're going to come out with the F-150 Lightning Flash. It's going to sit right in between the XLT and the Lariat trim. It's going to sit at about $70,000. It's also going to include a heat pump. So now all 2024 models are going to have a heat pump, which a huge, awesome thing to hear. And as far as clarification, on Twitter, I had asked one of their PR people if it was going to eliminate the resistive heating elements in the cabin and on the battery. Because if you do, some companies like Hyundai and the Nissan Ariya have both, which is a little bit of a hit on your efficiency in comparison to just having a traditional heat pump system like what Tesla's doing with the Octo Valve. So They had said that there is no resistive elements. So, you know, that's a good sign to hear that they're improving efficiency on that front. And also it includes a lot of other tech. So to me, it seems like, okay, Rivian's introducing MaxPack now. The F-150 Lightning Flash is now available. These guys are preparing for Cybertruck to come and hit the market and want to get those sales out. But I think it's also the consumers are having a hard time with financing. In the United States, everything is very expensive right now. It's really hard to get like competitive financing. So I think that they're working like against each other at this stage where it's hard for people to get. That's why they're offering all these, you know, trying to incentives, and Tesla dropped their prices again. So now, like just within the last 24 hours, I think a Model Y long range is $48,000 for the MSRP. So prices are starting to drop to try to get more people into. And now they also offer in the Model Y the rear wheel drive variant, which it used to be only all wheel drive in our market. So now you can get that even down into the low 40s, and they all qualify for the tax credit. So I think that car companies are really trying to not only get the price point down for the consumers as far as financing goes, to try to keep that, you know, train running, but also they know competition's coming with like Cybertruck and stuff like that. So I like to see all these figures. I'm kind of surprised that Volkswagen actually, it doesn't sell more ID4s, because as far as I know, that plant, well, they build the Atlas out of it as well. But even volume of the Atlas is not that high. And to have lower volume of ID4, like, are they doing that because they don't see the demand for ID4 going up so much? Because as far as I understand, that plant, when it was churning out Passats, it could get up to 150,000 units annually. So
I think this is the VW supply chain grimness continues. I think they just can't make enough of them to be selling them, because, like, certainly that's the case in Europe. So
there is also with ID4 the tiny consideration that it's not very good.
It's not terrible, but it's not like the best. Yes, I agree with that. But it does get the tax incentive here, and without going through the lease loophole or anything like that, so you can get the full credit on this as well. So
but it's I can get a bit of money off, but I don't really like it, and it's still got that awful infotainment system, which is the
on a
sort of slight tangent. A friend of mine was looking to buy a VW group product, not necessarily an ID car. And they said, what do you think? So I really like those, but before you give them lots of money, just try the infotainment systems. It was a used car. And she came back and went, yeah, I didn't buy it. Can't do it. So that might be contributing to ID4 sales, but in general, it's a good sign. Things are going well. Now, less news, more events. We've been doing things, the three of us, this week. Hazel and I, last night, went to see the David Brown Automotive Mini E-Mastered. We mentioned it on last week's podcast. It's a classic Mini with a new body on it and lots of beautiful paint and trim, and you can make it look and as you see fit. Apologies for the terrible phone picture.
Looks so good, though.
It's so pretty. But as you will now see on your screen, Lacey, we have the metric goy measurement of a Mini. It's about 1.5 metric goys.
Okay. Okay.
Everyone thought we were very normal at this point.
Yeah. I mean, we were, I think we were the only press there, because I didn't see anyone I recognized. And I think the rest of the people there were people they were hoping they were going to buy it. So there was us in the corner.
You know, sometimes you see people laying on the ground when they're looking at cars, but usually they're underneath it and like examining things.
Yeah.
I love this.
Yeah. Some adult beverages had been consumed shortly before in the hours leading up to such a moment. And their lovely comms rep was like, all right, do what you got to do. I think last
science.
Week we talked about science. It's all for science. As Seth has said in the comments, doing journalism.
Yes
Seth, we are doing a journalism. Yes, boss. all for the good of the podcast. Last week we touched on the spec, I think the last what they said to us last night was they were very, very honest about what the car is and who it's for. You know, they were saying it's a fourth, fifth, sixth car. It's not the kind of thing you'd rely on. So there's no reason to have fast charging in it, because that's not what you would use it for. So it just kind of, they've basically said, we don't need it. There's no point in having it. The customers that we have won't care about being able to do that thing. It's for a gentle potter around and it'll go back in the garage and you bang it on a charge. That's kind of it. It's as, I mean, Hazel, how did you put it last night? What is it? It's a Chanel handbag.
Yeah. It's a luxury item that you have because it's cute. That said, the tech is actually quite impressive because obviously this is an original Mini. It's not like they've done what a lot of companies are doing with their EVs to extract range and turn it into a perfectly smooth sort of marble. And it's only got an 18.8 kilowatt hour battery, which makes sense because it's got to fit somewhere in a Mini. And an original chassis Mini, you know, there's reinforcement and stuff, but this, it's not like they've made it bigger or anything.
No, I think they get the body that you can buy body shells, I think from British Motor Heritage or someone like that. Yeah. And they take it, they make sure it's rust proof, they de-seam it. So it's, you know, if you see the Minis of old, they've got kind of seams running down the back and all over the place. Those aren't on it and they change the rear lights, but that's cut, but it's still the same dimensions, 1.5 metric guys, as the original.
But so the range, or the estimated WLTP range, is 110 miles, which from 18.8 kilowatt hours in the battery capacity, this thing, I really underestimated this yesterday, actually, because I said it must have regen equivalent to the EQS. But that's just not true, because it must be getting 5.85 miles per kilowatt hour of original storage. So the regen must be incredibly efficient. Obviously, it's a little light car, and the fact that it only has 18.8 kilowatt hours of battery weight as well will be very, very important to that. But yeah, I was like, that is legitimately really impressive as a figure. Like, that's a very efficient car.
I mean, their head of engineering was quite honest while he was being interviewed on stage. Was like, there is a sport mode and that will impact the range quite dramatically. But if you just want to if you just want to go and potter around, there is a city mode, which I imagine will throttle it. They are going to let us drive it. I think drives are towards the end of the month and there'll probably be an embargo on it. But once I've had a go, I'll let you know how it is. But if it's anything like their petrol ones, it will be a sublime experience to sit in. But this time, really quiet. So, yeah, we got drunk and laid down next to EV-converted Minis. Lacey, you have been driving Mullins.
Yes.
Tell us, please do. What was it like? How was it? What did you get up to?
So I live in Michigan, and in the Detroit area, Mullen was coming to the M1 concourse. If you're familiar, that's a little racetrack that we have in Pontiac, Michigan. So not too far from where I'm. And I said, you know what? I saw that they were doing this tour stop, so I want to go over there and check everything out. So I signed up to do pretty much everything on the experience that they offered. Now, keep in mind, with most of the vehicles here, they're all pre-production prototype versions. So, like, for example, this one actually is the production version. So this is the Class 3 commercial truck, and I got to drive that, which was really cool. And I also got to drive the Class 1 version, which is their little, a smaller fleet vehicle. I actually had the opportunity to drive that before when that company was Electric Last Mile Solutions, and then Mullen acquired them in bankruptcy. So this and this Class 3 is also from that acquisition. So they had a little bit of a head start because some of those supply chain elements were already kind of underway when they had acquired them. The Class 1, technically, see that little one in the left corner, so we could take it on this little track. It's hard to kind of see because he couldn't get up and over the barriers here. But that whole area, that pit, is full of cones where we were going through, like, slalom and, you know, a bunch of different exercises to take the vehicle through and parking and stuff. But that little Class 1, I was able to drive that as well. The other consumer cars, the GT, which is their like coupe style performance vehicle, and then the Mullen 5, which is the SUV, I was a passenger in both of those. very fun experience. I will say the commercial 3, the one that is in production right now, seemed to me to be pretty fully baked and felt really great. No issues as far as it was smooth acceleration. I can see, you know, it is somewhat limited range and things like that, but for the application that it's supposed to serve, I think they'll sell enough to get that ramped up. And eventually the whole point here is for them to sell the fleet vehicles and get that production up and then be able to fund the consumer products. And I actually had the opportunity to talk to the VP of marketing as well. And so he provided some insights there, but I'm going to have a whole video that comes up about the whole experience. I was really actually shocked as to the operations size, because I consider Mullen being like kind of a smaller player, obviously, and technically now they only have one thing in production. They have a lot going on, but they had like 3 semi trucks. They had several different like parts of the experience, a small merchandise area that, you know, was a really nice like air conditioning unit for being outside at a track experience. They had the Bollinger B2, because Mullen has also acquired a portion of Bollinger to get their commercial operation up and running. And so then they can finally fund the B1 and B2. And Robert Bollinger was at the event, which was really cool to see him. I interviewed him a few years back. He was actually one of my first videos I ever produced on my channel, was sitting down at an interview at their headquarters in Michigan here. And so it was good to see him and catch up with him. And he's like, you got to come by and test out the big truck. And I know Seth, I think, had an experience going to M City and driving around in it, but he's like, I got a lot of updates to give you. So we'll make a time to sit down with him and get a video up on that too. They also had basically like on the on-track experience, it was, I would say with the consumer products, you could definitely tell they're still in that prototype phase. Like the fit and finish is not there. The quality of the components that they have in there, you can tell are just, it's a show car. It's just a piece. But as far as those powertrains go, like they felt pretty good. But they're a long way from going into production on that side of things. It's really what they're focusing on is that launching the commercial division so that they can fund the rest of the operation. But it was great. It was, you know, I was very surprised. I did not think that it would be the operation that it was that I saw. So I was really impressed.
I'm really surprised by the idea of sort of, and I understand there's a substantial element of this is that they've kind of like swept up quite a lot of other companies and stuff. But the whole kind of trying to nail the commercial, which I think there's a big market for, and there's clearly like people have tried and failed in that space, and if they're actually producing viable products, then they've got a huge opportunity there. But then trying to sort of semi at the same time, but as a later stage, introduce the consumer stuff. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It just feels like there's really large OEMs that can't manage to juggle this at the moment. I'd just be concerned.
Well, definitely if you look at like how the stock has performed, it's been like a wild journey for a lot of the stock holders. So I know that there's been a lot of turmoil as far as that goes, and I don't know too much about that front, and I didn't really get too much insight from the VP of marketing on all that, but he did give me plans about how they're laying it all out and, you know, what they hope to achieve. If they'll actually be able to achieve it, it's hard to say, but I just was really, because usually at this stage of the game, when you have an event like this, usually it's like a couple tents and maybe a few cars and a couple bodies, and then, you know, that's pretty much it. But I mean, it was like full blown, you know, all these big cubes and stuff like that holding cars and just the elements, the assets. And I've worked in the experiential marketing business. I actually used to do that type of work that those people were doing at that event for a very long time. So I know what goes into it. And so I was really just surprised how much of that was, you know, it looked really, really good. So somewhat promising, but again, it is, you know, one of those companies that's still getting their feet off the ground. So you got to kind of take it with a little bit of a grain of salt.
But the product you sampled
shows promise, which is a good, because I guess you find a lot of companies like that that go, oh, we're going to do a million miles and we're going to do this and here's our wonky. You can't touch the car, though. If you touch the car, it might vanish into dust.
Well, I mean, it, to be fair, like when you're in the prototype or show car phase, it's really easy to make one of those. It's not, it's really hard to get to manufacturing and production. So the stuff might look okay right now, but it's a whole nother ball of wax when you get into manufacturing. So I don't know. To me, it's like, yes, it was a fun experience and they handled well enough for what they were trying to ask for. Like in the GT, we went on the track and we got up to about like 170 miles per hour. Now he had to, you could tell he was my driver braking much earlier than I expected him to brake, considering the performance of the car. And he's like, oh, they're Brembos and stuff like that. But still, like, it, you can just tell, like, yes, this is still in the pre-production phase. So, and it's, he's, the VP of marketing said, it's going to be a couple of years until we can get the consumer line. So part of the acquisition of Electric Last Mile Solution was getting the old Hummer factory in Mishawaka, Indiana. And so that's where they said that they're going to be building those consumer production vehicles, including the Bollinger models, but commercial has to come first because it needs to be able to fund the rest of the stuff. So as long as the commercial stuff continues to, you know, churn out, and they're going to come out with the class one, a production version. That one I was not confident in, even though I drove that, like I mentioned, when it was Elms. The one that I drove back in the day when it was still Elms was more baked than what I experienced on this program, because there was a lot of motor like cogging, like it was not smooth, which, but they did add some elements like a rear backup camera and stuff, which was nice to see. But ultimately, like, they still have a little ways to go tweaking that. But it's basically just a bunch of supplier components that they're piecing together, as far as I understand. So they're just final assembly is what I'm getting from a lot of other suppliers.
Gotcha. Right. Well, Mullen sounds promising. Fingers crossed. I've been playing in something as well from after last night's jolly with an EV converted stalwart of the British countryside. Last week, I think it was last week, the days are all kind of rolling into one at the minute. Last week, I went up to Frontline Developments. It is an MG specialist. What it does is it takes MGs, MGBs, and makes them better. Started off as the idea of a chap called Tim Fenner, who had a wonky gearbox in his MG Midget race car, and he wanted it to be a bit better. So put a new one in and swiftly became basically the man to go to make your MG go faster. Over the years, they've done full restoration jobs, and they've also built individual models. So they had the LE50 and the Abingdon edition, which used, I think, Mazda 4-pots, and they were very quick and very entertaining. But the latest one, they've brought out two cars, the LE60, which has a big V8 in it, and the car that's on your screen right now, the MGB BEE, which was very sweet. It's got a 114 horsepower, 162 pound foot Hyper 9 motor. It's got a 40 kilowatt hour battery, and it's got a manual gearbox. And I had a go in it, and it was really quite fun.
So cute.
It's so cute. It's lots of money. Well, they haven't given a firm price. It's just a prototype at the minute. So the interesting thing about the stats is
that's one of those things where if you have to ask the price, you cannot afford it.
Yes, it is. It is definitely a case like that. The V8 that we were stood next to, the LE60, was £176,000 UK. So depending on how the exchange rates are going, it could be $20 or it could be 4,000 million. But it was, so it's lots of money. But the fascinating thing about it is, so it's sort of prototypey at the moment. There is a demand for it. They've got order logs ready to go. But they say, you know, it could go up to as much as 280 horsepower. And fast charge solutions are potentially on the way. Currently, it's slow charge. It's about 5 hours to get from 0 to 100. The range, they say, is about 140 miles. The thing itself, as you can see from the pictures, It's if you're following the live stream, if not, do a Google. It's gorgeous. It is so beautifully put together. It looks like the MGB that when you close your eyes, you see it. That's the car. The paintwork is flawless. The chrome work is beautiful. The grille is gorgeous. They'll do it as a roadster or a coupe. I had the coupe, and it's just stunning. Like every inch of work that's gone into it, you can see where the money goes outside and inside. The upholstery is gorgeous. The touch points, none of them wobble or waggle or anything like that, which you kind of expect from a car like that. But the driving experience, it's got a 5-speed manual gearbox. So you turn it on and it makes a couple of whirry noises, and then you put it into first, and then you lift your foot off the clutch and nothing happens, because you're not going to stall the engine, because there's not an engine. It's a Hyper 9 motor. So it just sits there at 0 RPM, and you've got to sort of very gently put your foot on the gas, the throttle, and it'll slowly move away, and it'll whir, and it'll make lots of very pleasant noises. But when you're changing up, it's nice and simple. It's that Miata gearbox, so it's gorgeous. You know, snick, 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 snick.
Do you have to stick the clutch down to change?
Yeah,
gear.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's the weird thing, right? So you don't have to, when you're changing up, you don't necessarily have to do any blending. But when you're changing down, because the motor's spinning at higher revs, or the motor and transmission is spinning differently, you do have to do a little bit of rev matching. Otherwise, you'll end up doing that thing that learners do when they go from, I don't know, fourth to third, and you kind of get that awful bumpy deceleration. It's quite bizarre, but when you kind of nail it, it works. You still get that engagement with the drive. So I was driving around little country lanes and kind of banging it from, you know, second, third, fourth, fourth, third, second, and playing with it. And it was just mega. But there are a few things that there's one thing that you forget, because it's not a traditional internal combustion engine car. When you pull up to a junction, you do dip the clutch. Because you go, oh, I'll stall if I have no revs on. But realistically, that's not the case. And you can bang it in fourth and just set off at super, super low revs and use as little electricity as possible. It's really quite a bizarre thing. I've driven a few manual EVs now. You know, I've had an original Porsche 356 with the original transmission in it. That was delicate, but, you know, worked largely the same. I had a Mini with a Citroen C1 gearbox in it, and now this with the Miatas in it. And that, pardon me, that gearbox is just so good, and it's so wonderfully tactile to use. Pardon me. I adore it. As a solution goes for people that go, oh, there's no engagement in EVs, that's not true. You can have a little EV sports car. You just have to spend a lot
200 grand.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of money. But yeah, you know, it's companies like this that are able to do it because their customers have been asking about an EV. They wouldn't have done it if there wasn't money in it for them. And the cool thing. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, as all I was gonna say was, like, you can't tell that it's not a petrol MGB unless you look for an exhaust, and there isn't one. But the fuel filler cap in the rear, that's where the plug is.
It's so cute. It's like hidden perfectly.
Yeah, it's just beautifully done.
I have always loved. I know, like, when we first started, one of our first episodes as the new crew on the podcast, I had said, you know, I love the E-Type. It's just one of the classics that I appreciate and that people have thrown an electric powertrain in, but to be realistic, I know I would always love one of those, probably never can afford one, but I've always loved the MGA, like, and I've always wanted to convert one of those, because I feel like it's like the poorer version of the the E-Type, a convertible that white with red interior, but I would love to convert. So I've always had a soft spot for, like, and I don't like the MGBs with the big bumper that's like gaudy and black, but this time frame, love it.
You mean the federal spec US, the US spec black, exactly, rubber bumper, because it had to be had.
Brutal. Yeah. Oh, I hate that. Yeah. But they're like, you can find them like all over the place. If you want to buy a used one, they're everywhere. And, you know, so you have parts and stuff like that that you can replace relatively easily. But the MGA is like the convertible version. And I was just like, if I could get one of those, that would be so cool as an EV conversion. That's one of like my dream EV conversion cars, because I can't ever afford the E-Type, basically.
Well, we know a company that can do it for you, though I imagine if you can't afford an E-Type, this might also be a little jazzy. I think Frontline's conversion might be a little pointy. There are other ways to do it, though. But no, it was a very, very cool thing. I was very lucky to have driven it and glad to have shared it with you all. Now we've covered the news, we've covered drives, we've covered metric goy sizes of Mini. It's time for Tesla news.
Tesla news.
Ah, Tesla. It's been a busy week for Tesla. So the semi has been it's been rocking. The first we mentioned that a little earlier that Tesla has built 60 to 70 of the semi trucks, and that pricing is very competitive. Now, the way that where this came up, though, is the man himself, the denim clad individual, Jay Leno, has had a bit of a drive. He's had a play in it and he really liked it. Lacey, you've seen it in depth. What do you think? Tell us all about it.
Oh, I loved this video. If you guys have the opportunity to watch it, it's on Jay Leno's Garage on YouTube. And basically what happened is they brought the semi to him or he went to one. I don't know. But then they had Franz, who is the head designer at Tesla, and the chief engineer of the semi truck was there as well. And they told him everything that he had asked about that. And what I just love about Jay is that he is a man that is, you know, serves the like very enthusiast crowd because of his collection and wide breadth of knowledge with all the vehicles that he has. He also loves EVs, which is really cool, but also the everyday person. So he's just this perfect like blend, I think, to have the opportunity to show this off to his audience, because there's so many people, I think, that will appreciate this, even if they aren't a car enthusiast. And it was incredible to see him driving this thing around. He's like, it feels like nothing. When he put that big trailer on the back with the other semi on it, he was like, nope, this guy can't feel anything. This feels great. I will say some of the footage was kind of interesting to see. You could tell that they didn't stabilize the GoPro at this angle. It was shaking a lot. So there's quite a bit of vibration there. Otherwise, like, I was incredibly impressed with how quiet the interior space was. Because if you're sitting in a truck like that, they can't have a conversation. Like, they'd be yelling at each other, and they were talking at normal before they even took off. It was like the same tone of voice and volume of them sitting next to each other, just having a conversation. And you could hear the like ambient noise, but it was very minimal. Very cool to see. They said the drag coefficient of this thing is 0.4, which is kind of impressive considering these guys were saying that most of the competition is like double that. So seeing the innovation there, why they structured things the way they did, is also just very impressive. They said that they are going to be eventually coming out with like a sleeper version. So I think that's really nice to hear. And hopefully they'll be ramping up production, which is probably why they're doing these segments, is they're going to start getting that volume production up. And also recently I saw that there was an article, I think it was on Inside EVs, where they were talking about the Run for Less program, where we had covered that maybe like a week or so, where semis were involved at PepsiCo. They were tracking how their deliveries. Mm-hmm. One of them did 1,000 miles in a day.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to lead on to. So they've a Pepsi Tesla semi has covered 1,000 miles in a workday, but the numbers that, because they've been tracking these like in minute detail, the 17th day of their test program, the rig that's labeled as Tesla 3 logged a total of 1,076 miles, but made one delivery. So I'm guessing it's a long way there and a long way back. But they have been doing some like incredible distances. The rig spent 81.8% of the day driving, 11.1% of the time charging, was inactive for 17% of the day. The majority of trips, 92.6%, were done at over 50 miles an hour. So numbers like that and figures like that, it shows that that all the naysayers go, well, yeah, it's nothing compared to a diesel. Oh, I won't do what a diesel does. Actually, it will, like, quite comfortably do it, and it will kick ass in the process. The numbers are quite incredible. What I especially appreciate about this, though, is that they're being very open with them. Mm-hmm. I think there's perhaps for that market where it isn't, you know, your uncle around the corner who says, oh, I've got one of those Teslas. Oh, it's really quick and it's really great. For this, you need to prove that these vehicles do it. And it's you know, it's one thing saying that it will do 1,000 miles in a day and it's absolutely fine. But it's another thing proving it.
One thing that he mentioned in the video, and I might be misquoting this, but I really highly encourage, it's so fascinating to me watching this and learning about this, but the chief engineer was saying that the amount of money that is saved with going annually is like over $200,000 in fuel costs, which is just crazy. And I might even be like hitting that wrong, but just the figures that he was allowed to give and talk about, it was just like incredible to hear. That side of things is like, yes, why wouldn't a company, if it can do this 1,000-mile route, why wouldn't they venture for that? And I really like that in the Inside EV's article, like, talked about the trip itself, where they started at 95% state of charge and then 357 miles and then they took their first charge, but then they only charged, you know, a little bit to 50% state of charge, and then they drove again and then they stopped for an hour and a half and charged up pretty close to all the way and then took another 300 and some odd. Like, it is incredible to see how, like, this is so game changing. I'm so excited for this to become like a thing. And then, of course, we see like Freightliner, Z Cascadia and stuff like that, but in comparison, they were like doing not even 200 miles for their trip. So this Tesla is changing the game as far as, you know, this freight stuff. And he was saying they're using semis now to transport like battery packs from the factories to be able to reduce the cost on that. So, you know, they don't have the freight costs on moving those components, and they're saving a ton of money on that regard. So they're even benefiting right now using them in their fleet.
I also enjoyed that in the video, he asked about the power, because obviously power, and being a child, they said the system horsepower is around 1500 horsepower, which is quite a lot, but it doesn't use it all the time. I imagine it would just cook its tires in 30 seconds flat and go through all its range. But the fact that it's there, and the torque you get with that, which means you can tow big things, like in the video, another Tesla Semi.
Well, yeah, and they specifically said that the motors are on those rear wheels, so there's no motor on the front wheel, which is going to help as far as traction goes with, like you were mentioning, burning out those tires. So they've strategically placed it so that they're on the dually end of the truck. And another thing that they said was that this will operate on similar architecture as the Cybertruck, with a 800 volt to a 1,000 volt power plant. So, yeah, that's cool to hear as well.
It's a mega mega thing, like genuinely hugely impressive bit of kit.
Such a great video. Really, I highly recommend. Yeah, go watch
it. Like to see these numbers coming out with BEV trucks, because trucks is one of the places that like hydrogen is really being pushed. Because you can hide a big ass fuel stack, you can, like, there is space on a truck to distribute the tanks, etc. And every time someone's kind of come up with a design for this, it's generally also had to have some kind of battery system for regen or for pre-charging, because otherwise you're losing a lot of the advantage. You're also adding so much weight with the hydrogen tanks and the fuel stack that it starts all becoming a bit horrible. But yeah, for that not to need to be something that the truck industry is really pursuing in order to create zero emissions vehicles, is I think, very optimistic. You know, the problems with hydrogen are becoming more and more manifest, including the fact there was a paper published today that the hydrogen industry is going to lobby to not get forever plastics banned in Europe because they have to use them. And it's like, clearly there are some issues with batteries. There are environmental issues. There's lots of things that we need to do better. There's lots of things that we need to do better with all kinds of things about moving stuff and ourselves around. To see this feels very optimistic in a way where haulage has been something where people are like, it would be so nice if we could, but we can't. It's like, this feels very positive.
It feels right.
Another thing is that it was crazy in the videos they show him doing a U-turn in an intersection. And this turning circle is funny to see with a semi-truck. I think he said it was like the same or very close to like the Model 3 or something like that. Again, I'm probably misquoting some stuff, but you have to watch this video. It's so fascinating. And for this thing to turn on a dime is just wild. I did notice that it was kind of interesting. I didn't see his seat moving up and down. In a lot of cases, when you're in those types of vehicles with all the vibration and everything, your seat can fluctuate a little bit. So it looked like I don't know if there's any suspension in that seat or anything like that, but maybe that would be helpful.
Maybe it's an option. It's a cost option.
The center driving position, though, it's like Jay, you know, the F1, like, he's like, this is like the perfect driving position and everything like that. So it's just so cool. I love this.
As our time is running a little slim, so there is a little bit more Tesla news to talk about. The Cybertruck is a coming. It's a thing that is definitely happening. We know that now. Last week, we had a quote from Elon Musk saying that he'd driven the performance variant of it, and he said it kicked ass next level, which is just brilliant. But someone has come out and said that it exists, it's real, and it's likely to have the plaid setup, the tri-motor plaid setup that you get in the Model S and the Model X, which means 1,020 horsepower in those cars. 0 to 60 happens in 2.5 seconds with a rollout, which means it's probably closer to 3, which still isn't a bad time at all. That's still, you know, gut rearrangingly quick, because this is a bit bigger and a bit heavier. They're estimating, you know, close to 3.5. Still not bad. Do we think we need a performance oriented Cybertruck? Do you think?
Hell yeah.
Okay. Just a nice dose of Murica. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The idea of a 1,000 horsepower Cybertruck. It seems stupid. I mean, it's a big angry triangle. It looks like something out of the Imperial fleet. I can imagine Vader stepping out of it with his helmet on backwards, having just been given a hard launch.
Yes. Tim, my producer, has a couple of these on order, and he's very excited. He doesn't stop. He literally, it's, you know, that trend that went around was like, oh, the Roman Empire, like, how many times a day do you think about it? He's like, I think about Cybertruck every day, pretty much all day. Like, so he's so excited for this, and it's ridiculous. I'm like, the thing is absurd looking. But I think they're not going to have a problem selling whatever they bring out of it, like, weirdly enough, because it's so hideous in my opinion. And I think a lot of people agree with me, but I do like the fact that they're coming out with the performance variant. And supposedly the tri-motor setup was supposed to come with the bigger battery pack that initially was quoted to get 500 miles of range.
Right.
So we'll see what ends up happening on that front, because I have heard Elon kind of say things like, well, people only need 300 or blah, 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 blah. So I feel like he kind of was trying to pull that back for expectations wise, like a while back, not recently. But I think people will be very happy with the fact that there's going to be a tri-motor setup and hopefully a big battery. Will it come first, though? That's the thing I want to know. It's like, what's coming first? Probably the more profitable stuff, but we don't know for sure.
it'll be a glitzy launch event that we know is going to happen. It'll be like, well, we've started production, and if you want the really fast one, you can order it now. But it doesn't look that slow. There's a video this week of a man who was at the time in control of a car, leaning out the window of said car at a stoplight, taking video, which should be frowned upon. But he did capture a Cybertruck doing a pretty brisk launch for the public highway. That thing shifts. That thing properly shifts. It's very, very cool. One final bit on the Cybertruck. Someone's got some drone footage. Like, Tesla has a real drone problem around its factories.
Do you think that's on accident? They let this dude fly around multiple times a week. Let's try to hide this crash testing thing. Like, you got like the perfect shot peeking into it.
why don't you try over in that hangar over there? There's nothing in that hangar over there. But there's some video and some stills. They've done a crash test, and it looks like it's been crashed, but it doesn't look like it's suffered particularly badly. So, you know, it will survive an accident by the looks of things. It doesn't look too beat up. Don't know what the circumstance of their testing was. Was it, you know, Euro NCAP style? They launched them into walls at 30 miles an hour, or was it depending on what it was? But airbags have been deployed. Things that are supposed to deform have deformed. And it doesn't look like there's a pool of blood underneath it. So that's obviously a win. But it's all building the hype. So I know there's another bit of news coming, like the team gear for a launch event has been spotted in the wild. So it's coming. And all this build, all this like being seen in public doing launches, the crash tests. And weirdly, after so long and after so many disappointments, I'm weirdly excited for it now. I want to see the big angry triangle on the road.
I think we're getting close. I think that the event will be before the end of the month, but we'll see. Let's do a Halloween Cybertruck party. Tim and I were talking. It's like they've been shipping a lot of Cybertrucks around the country. How cool would it be if they, like, in conjunction with their main event in Texas, did like these regional like launch parties. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting a little too. I mean, I don't even like the look of it, but I just think it's so fun because people have been waiting for so freaking long for this truck. Yeah. And it's so weird.
And what if they did a launch event at your house where they just left you a car?
I would not be upset about that.
I would not be mad. And on that is our show. So a huge thanks to the wonderful Hazel Southwell. Thank you, Hazel. And to Lacey, Miss Go Electric. If you have, and also our producer in the background, who has been doing all of the screen moving and making all the noises happen, Danny Howard. Thank you so much. You are awesome.
Danny the man.
If you have any comments, questions, anything you want to say to us, do be sure to send an email to contact@insideevs.com. Let us know, say hi, say nice things, because we're people too. And on that, we shall leave you. We'll see you at about see you same time next week. And there's some police outside my house. Great. Cheers, everyone.
They've come for you, Alex.